Welcome to Live Life Better. This is Scott Eastwood. I want you to live the best version of your life. We're all human beings, all just trying to figure it out. Find something you love and chase it.
We speeding.
We're doing Jeff first, right? Not her.
We're not. We're not doing that one. Timothy, no, we're not. Today, we are talking to Jeff O'Connell. That's right. He is the author of Sugar Nation. That is right. I read this book about 6 months ago, and I loved it. It is an incredible story about overcoming diabetes. That is right, America. It is what one in three people have today. We have a massive epidemic going on, and we need to open our eyes. So check out this podcast, because it's got some dope information. Yeah.
I'm going to give you some direction. Give me the map, Scott.
We started just because we were like, you know what? Let's do one, and let's interview interesting people and people who are doing interesting, positive things in their lives and live really cool stories. And let's just have it be a conversation and see if, you know, people want to listen. And if they don't, they can tell us, hey, get the fuck out of here. Like, you guys don't know what you're talking about, which is okay too. Yeah.
Hopefully this won't be the one that kind of sinks your podcast.
see if you can get in there closer, Jeff. Or no, you can pull the microphone, whatever's comfortable sitting wise.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, you know, like I was saying earlier, people don't, right, especially in LA, right? You used to live here.
I lived here for 10 years and then left for quite a while. So,
and I'm sure you noticed a difference, right? Like in LA, it's hard to sit and have a conversation with someone when you're living this like really busy life because everything's like going, beep, 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 beep. Blah, 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 blah. And it's like just everything's relentless and people are here for a reason typically, right? It's usually to advance their career. So it's like, I don't live here anymore either. I don't live in LA anymore. Okay. And I find it's easier to have conversations with people, like sit and actually have like an analytical conversation and talk about things that, you know, like dive deep into someone's life.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, your life.
Nice segue.
Yeah. is like an incredible story. I read Sugar Nation about a year ago, I want to say. Was it a year ago? 6 months ago?
Did my agent send it to you?
I picked it up in, I don't remember if I ordered it. I don't remember, but I picked it up and I was fascinated by it. And then I was really fascinated by to learn that, you know, to learn your story. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, looking at you right now, like I wouldn't think that you'd be told you had diabetes.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of one of the whole points of the book is I'm the least likeliest person to get it.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, for people who aren't watching, you are skinny, you're tall, you're what, 6'4"?
6'7", actually.
6'7", geez.
6'7", 190, so.
I'm not that good of judge's size, never happened. You look fit, you know? Mm-hmm. You were an editor, right, for Bodybuilding Magazine?
Well, at the time, I mean, the genesis of Sugar Nation, at that time I was actually working for Men's Health Magazine.
Men's Health.
Even more ironic in a sense, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the story behind that was that I was working for Men's Health. My title was executive writer, so I had to interview mostly like actors for cover stories.
Sure. Dumb actors.
Yeah.
Man.
Actors with six-pack abs and stuff like that. So just cruising along. At the same time, I had been estranged from my father for probably 15, maybe 20 years. Had no contact whatsoever with him. So then one day out of the blue, I got a call from a really distant relative telling me that my father had one of his legs amputated, which was horrifying news, of course.
Crazy.
And secondarily, that he had an amputation because he had type 2 diabetes, which seemed totally strange because, you know, my father had been a high school basketball star, like me, a tall, thin guy. And even after high school as an adult, as he raised me, he was always pretty thin. Like, he was the last person you'd expect to have diabetes. So I heard that news. And then coincidentally, I had a doctor's appointment like a week later. Just a routine physical. They drew blood. They went through the test. The doctor sat down and he started going through the scores. And the first thing he said was, does diabetes run in your family?
Jeez, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
That's terribly rude. He'd throw this thing out the window. Let's blow it up. We should blow it up. We'll blow it up for you guys. Sorry, continue.
Yeah, so the doctor said, does diabetes run in your family? So given that I just heard a few days earlier that my father had had an amputation.
Was this after you prompted, hey, would you check for diabetes?
No, I kid you not that this was, I had just a routine physical exam scheduled that happened to fall like a week after I heard that news.
At what age were you at this?
Mid-40s.
Mid-40s, wow.
Yeah, so that sort of set me on this whole journey. Because first of all, it didn't make sense to me that my father, a tall, thin guy, had gotten diabetes. And then why am I, equally tall and thin, getting it too? So that set me on this whole journey to discover how thin people can get diabetes and then just why so many people of all shapes and sizes get diabetes.
So they tell you, hey, you're are they, do they say pre-diabetic? I can't remember.
Yeah, I was pre-diabetic. Pre-diabetic is your blood sugar is between 100 and 125. So below 100, you're normal glucose metabolism. Above 126, you're considered full-on type 2 diabetes. And I was right at the cusp between pre-diabetes and type 2. And I'm sure I'd been over that line. You sort of, it's not like a fixed number. You kind of move up and down.
Okay.
Depending on what you're eating and how much you're working out at a given moment. So
when you say you move up and down, like when you're pre-diabetes, you can correct that before you get diabetes?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Basically diet and nutrition. But most people think you can, like it's some kind of death sentence you get. But even type 2 diabetes, you can, unless your pancreas is totally
toast, shot
at a certain point, you can, generally speaking, bring your blood sugar back down to a healthier level. Mostly it's usually losing weight if people are overweight. Cutting back on carbohydrate is always a big part of it. And usually working out too. Problem is a lot of people don't want to do all that stuff. So,
yeah, a lot of people don't want to put the work in.
Right.
You say cutting back carbohydrates. Is that being probably the first and foremost thing the doctor would tell you to do first, or is it refined sugar?
They should tell you to cut back carbohydrates. Usually they don't. They tell you to cut back on fat, which has no impact whatsoever.
This is American Association of Diabetes?
Right, and the American Dietetic Association, all sort of the mainstream so-called experts,
who
you think would know this stuff. Fat really has very little to do. Your blood sugar does not react to fat at all. It doesn't go up or down in response to it. So you should cut back on carbohydrate. Refined sugar is the worst of it, but all carbohydrates except for fiber eventually become glucose in your bloodstream.
Sure.
So it really is more carbohydrate than sugar at the end of the day.
And they don't tell you that though? Doctor never told you that?
No.
Wow.
Which is crazy. Even the ADA is not sort of hip to the fact that carbohydrate is really the key behind type 2 diabetes, which is almost unthinkable, but true, unfortunately.
Is it they don't have the knowledge, or is there some other?
Well, I think going back decades, there's always been this sort of movement within mainstream nutrition that fat was the cult making people obese, that fat was causing diabetes, and they've sort of been invested in that theory now for probably 20 or 30 years, and it's hard to let go of that because all of their literature, all of their treatment plans are based around that paradigm. But I think in recent years, it's really becoming apparent to a lot of people, not just my book, but tons of other experts have come up with the idea that, no, it's carbohydrate is really the key to it, and calories in general, but particularly carbohydrate.
When you say calories in general, you mean like balancing the calories you burn versus what you intake, right?
Just not consuming too many. So if you consume more, then you somehow have to burn that off, or it's going to end up being body fat.
Sure. So, my buddy always says... he's on the cockroach diet.
What is the cockroach diet?
No, he's like, and it's true though, like just less of everything, right? Like we're so conditioned to eat like these three square meals and like, you know, eat a bunch of food and like have our carbohydrates, our protein and like this and that, and then our dessert. And you're like, what the fuck? Yeah. Like this is so not right. Like you don't need that much food to survive.
And even as kids, like parents tell their kids, you know, you have to finish your plate, you have to clean your plate. So they're kind of conditioned to eat even after they're totally satiated.
Yeah, and eat till you're like that feeling of full, right? Like that gluttonous.
Just bursting at the seams.
Yeah, and it feels terrible. Like it's so weird. It's when you start eating less and you just like condition yourself to not think you need to eat so much, you feel good.
Yeah.
you feel really good. And I know it's hard for some people to, they're like, oh, I'm so hungry though, I'm so hungry. But that like the chemistry in your brain changes if you like force it, if you actually try to do it. I promise anyone who's listening, if you, like I'll do intermittent fasting sometimes.
Oh, you've tried that?
Yeah, I'll do it. I'll bounce around, you know, not saying that that's like the be of end all, but the first week or two is hard, right? Because you're super conditioned, like, oh, yeah. Like I need to have something to eat. And then after about a week, it'll change. You'll be like, oh, I actually feel really good not eating. You know, I feel like, and then you're really aware of what that next meal you're going to put into your body is, mm-hmm. right? Like you're like hyper aware. You're like, ooh, if I eat a cheeseburger right now with like a bunch of fries and gravy and like all this crap, I'm going to feel like shit.
And probably throw it up, you know?
Yeah.
You can't, yeah, your body would be so shocked by it.
Yeah. So, okay, wait. I want to rewind just a little bit because okay. Your story is amazing. I got to go back to your dad just for a second because how does one go from getting type 2 diabetes to getting their leg amputated?
Well, I don't fully know because, like I said, he and I had been estranged.
Okay.
But the doctors I talked to after, as I was writing the book and kind of explaining his story, told me that to get to the point where they're cutting your leg off, and in his case, it was above the knee. I think they call it a Civil War amputation. That it's almost unthinkable that somebody's disease would be that far advanced that they're kind of being, you know, carted off in an ambulance to a hospital and having their leg amputated. So I can only assume that he neglected it incredibly, which isn't a shock to me. That he's probably warned a multitude of times by his physicians, hey, this is bad. Hey, this is getting worse.
Got it.
And I think for my father, if I had to guess, and I guess, I'm just sort of surmising that it was kind of out of sight, out of mind, and until it was way too late and sort of catastrophic in his case.
Okay. So your father, you find out then you are a pre-diabetic. What is that like? Do you feel any different when you left it? I mean,
not really, no. I think you feel sluggish. You don't realize that like your energy systems aren't working as well as they should. You're tired a lot. You eat a meal, especially a high carbohydrate meal, and you're suddenly yawning and you feel like you need to take a nap.
Mm.
But it's not really acute enough to make you think you have a disease or something like that.
So this was probably going on for years and you just had no idea.
It's a steady progression. It occurs over time. So 1 out of 3 U.S. adults has prediabetes and 10% of them know that they have it, which is the most mind-boggling health stat imaginable. 90% of the people with prediabetes have no idea. Until down the road, something much worse is going to happen. My father being an extreme case, but
sure. What's interesting about that is like, it's a known thing, right? Like the diabetes is a really known thing, and it would be like if a severe case of like the bird flu happened, and the American Disease Control, like we're there on site, like dealing with this problem ASAP. But they're not for diabetes, right? Like we know it's like a real big problem and it's dietary based and it's like how we treat our body. It's diet and exercise. Yeah. But there's no like immediate, like we got to deal with this. Yeah. Just like, deal with it.
Yeah.
Or don't, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a really stealthy disease. It's kind of an invisible epidemic. It's just happening and no one really knows what's going on because again, it's so subtle and it takes time, but if you look at all the healthcare statistics about how much money we're spending on kidney dialysis and heart surgeries and things like that, so much of that can be traced back to the fact that so many people have diabetes because that's what leads to, more often than not, to kidney disease and heart disease.
So is that the natural progression of diabetes for the listener here? What happens? So you're pre-diabetic, like they tell you are at that moment.
So at that point, you have elevated levels of blood glucose floating through your veins. It should be in your cells, but it's actually floating through your body.
Literally like
in your brain.
More sugar, right?
Glucose breaks down to it, right? Yeah. I use the phrase in the book that it sort of gunks up the works. I mean, it sounds colloquial, but it really just starts sticking to things. It leads to heart disease, atherosclerosis. Your stroke risk goes to the roof just because the inside of your vessels are getting clogged up with sugar and plaque formation from that.
Mm. So then what? Then what's the next?
Your kidneys, eventually your kidneys are one of the first things to go.
To fail.
To fail, yeah. And heart disease and type 2 diabetes go like hand in hand. So it's virtually inevitable that if you have type 2 diabetes, you have some level of heart disease, and eventually that's probably what's going to kill you. Wow. You don't really die per se from type 2 diabetes. You die from the heart disease or the kidney disease
that you get from cardiac arrest. Like someone will have a heart attack, right?
Yeah.
Or a stroke.
And it may very well because they had diabetes, which is another reason why it's kind of invisible and not given the seriousness it should, is that oftentimes the cause of death is something else.
Wow.
But it actually was the root cause of it.
So they didn't tell you, hey, carbohydrates, might want to stay away from those.
No. So I had to find that out on my own.
How do you find that out?
Well, luckily I work for Men's Health magazine.
Sure.
Which is a privilege that most people don't have when they get a diagnosis. So I just started, there were some people on the magazine staff who already had done some work suggesting that the ADA's approach was really backwards. So I kind of talked to them. And that kind of set me on a journey of just talking to experts and doctors who were sort of hip to the fact that carbohydrate was the root cause of this problem. And I went to the ADA's annual conference. I went to traveled to all places across the country, just learning about the disease and seeing populations that are highly impacted by it, like indigenous peoples in Canada. Mm. Because their body hasn't really evolved to the degree that, like when they're exposed to like fast food and stuff like that, it's a real shock because they're not that far evolved from sort of their ancestral gene pool. So that's
the hunter-gatherer gene pool?
Yeah. If they suddenly start eating McDonald's and stuff like that, they get overweight really quickly, but they get diabetes almost at warp speed. So
really?
Yeah.
Because we've evolved slightly more to eat shitty food?
A little bit, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
I know. It's
the worst thing I've ever heard. I'm laughing, but it's terrible. I mean, that's that's really fucked up.
So all over the world, like in Australia, their indigenous populations, their rates of diabetes and kidney disease are way, way higher than ours. It's like 60, 70% of the people have diabetes.
Wow.
So
you find out, okay, that's a huge problem. I got to stay away from carbohydrates, or at least like heavy carbohydrates. So then you start doing that.
Yeah, I cut my carbs back almost immediately. I went on the Atkins diet, basically.
Sure.
So I did what they call the induction phase. So initially you cut back to like 20 grams per day, which is really, really low.
Did you feel low energy?
Not really. Kind of like you. Like I was kind of surprised that, wow, I actually feel more energetic. Like carbs, you know, you're always told that carbs are the source of all your energy and you should drink Gatorade before your workouts and all that stuff. But the opposite happened. I actually felt more energetic. My mental acuity was much, much higher.
Really?
So I didn't miss carbohydrates at all, really, except that I enjoy them. I mean, they're delicious. That's sort of the downside. But
pasta's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so you cut that back, and then where was your blood sugar? I mean, I'm sure we were getting like, okay, I got to get tested now and figure out if it's affecting it, if it's not affecting it.
Yeah.
What did you notice first?
I went back to get tested about 6 months later, and it was under 100. So I went from like 120 to about 99. So I'm not sure if I can ever get back to like 80, which would be like perfect glucose metabolism.
Really?
I think because of some genetic predisposition or whatever.
Oh, okay.
But I was able to get under 100, which technically is healthy, even though it's too close to prediabetes for comfort. But
got it.
So yeah, I considered that an accomplishment. You know, I didn't want it to go in the other direction, basically. So I was happy to get it under 100. And that's super low carb diet, exercising pretty much every day.
What kind of exercise?
Resistance training first and foremost, so weights and cardio as well. But weight training is really underrated as a antidote to diabetes.
Why weight training versus cardio?
Just because muscle tissue creates cells for that sugar to go into instead of floating around in your bloodstream. Mm. So
I could see that.
The more muscle tissue you have, the more it's sort of, it's like a sponge that can soak up that glucose.
Absorbs it a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the cardio is important, of course, for weight management and also for heart health. But
sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'm a little slacking on cardio this week.
You always ate healthy, pretty much. I mean,
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
I
ate junk food. And the problem
was
I could
just cut out pasta. What was your diet?
Fast food.
What was your diet previously?
I ate a lot of fast food. I don't really cook, so I would just get like a Big Mac and fries.
Like every day?
Not every day, but... The problem is I could eat whatever I wanted and not get heavy. So
sure.
It kind of gave me a free pass to basically go to town and do whatever I wanted. So I'd gone fits and starts where I tried to eat a little bit healthier, like oatmeal and eggs in the morning and stuff like that. But yeah, it was really when I got that wake up call that I got really strict about my diet.
Got it. Yeah, I've had also, you know, because I work out a lot and because I have pretty good genes, I'm able to like throw in a cheeseburger, you know, every once in a while and
right,
you know, just be able to burn it off.
Which is not a bad thing. If you're working out like you are and, yeah, you're probably not even predisposed to this disease, so there's no harm in.
But I don't remember the last time I got my blood sugar checked. I mean, I've had plenty of blood tests, you know. I actually just had a physical for a movie today, randomly.
You have to do a physical before a movie?
Yeah, they want like everything from me now. They want blood tests, urine tests, EKG, like a stress test on my heart. Hmm. I mean, it's a big deal. I'm like, what? I'm like, I'm fine. What's wrong with
this?
Is
this like an action adventure type thing? Or?
It's an action. Well, yeah, there's a lot of action, a lot of running around and stuff in this film. It's a war film. But yeah, there's just a lot of, you know, a lot of money they're investing in, and if they have to protect that asset, right?
Sure.
So if I croak on them, they're like, you know, they're like, no, you insured him.
My hunch would be that if you had high blood sugar, that would have showed on the.
I'm sure it would have, right? Yeah. Is that? I mean, that's pretty standard.
It is. Well, yeah.
We'll find out tomorrow or the next day.
Right.
I feel good. I feel fine. No, but I don't eat fast food a lot. But I do sneak it in once in a while. It's too common. It's too widely available, and that's what's so dangerous about it.
It's too easy.
It's too easy, and it's. I mean, and I don't. I mean, I'm talking when I say I slip it in. I do. You know, tacos from Jack in the Box. You know, once every 3 months or something, you know, it's like, okay, cool. But I, you know, worked out twice today. But people live off of it.
Oh,
like
absolutely.
It blows my mind that people, and then they also let their children live off of it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what? No.
Or teach their children to live off of
it. Yeah. It's so bad.
It's just so lazy.
It's so lazy.
But I mean, there are other factors too. It's really cheap, and it's really cheap energy, and a lot of people don't have a lot of money. But I think there's always a better alternative than basically poisoning your kids. You know,
what would you say better alternatives are? Because that is like always people ask me, like, well, why don't you offer up better alternatives? And I'm like, okay, I will.
I think people need to cook first and foremost, especially like a family. That's the key.
Yep.
Just prepare your food at home, and you're instantly going to cut down on those massive meals like a Big Mac, a large fry, like a 32-ounce soda. I mean, the amount of sugar in that meal is enough to practically cause a
heart attack. Horse.
Exactly, yeah. So I think cooking is probably the most important thing for people. And just become aware of what they're putting in their body.
Sure.
I mean, typically the pancreas can handle about 30 grams of carbs at a meal without getting overwhelmed and overstressed. And one Coke is like 40 grams. So if you're having the Coke and then the large fries and then, you know, a Big Mac with a bun. I mean, that's probably 5-6 times the amount they should have. And then they do it over and over again, day after day. So
I don't drink soda. I never got that. I never liked the way it made me feel. Mm-hmm. Like the sugar.
Once you're off it, it's disgusting to go back to it.
Oh,
you know, it's
I'll
like,
never have
you can't that. Imagine that you ever actually drank that
yeah.
stuff. But
yeah, I used to, I take that back. There was a moment when I was 18, I was drinking Crown and Cokes. I was in college. Stupid. But I mean, I'm thinking about all the sugar that was in there. I was like, oh. But yeah, I don't drink soda. It's never been in my repertoire.
What about diet soda?
Nope. I don't like any of it. I just drink water.
Yeah. The first thing I did was switch from regular soda to diet. Now I don't drink any of it.
Yeah.
So
is diet soda any better? I mean,
it's
less sugar, but it's all chemical, right?
It is, but specific to diabetes, it is better just to get that sugar out of your diet. I'm not saying diet soda is a health tonic by any stretch of the imagination,
sure.
And better to not have any soda at all.
Yeah.
But specifically for diabetes, the fact that it doesn't have sugar is a benefit.
So speaking of sugar, will you break down the difference between added sugar and natural sugar?
Yeah, so natural sugar is what, as the word says, naturally occurs in food. So when you eat an apple, which seems like a health food, and it is, that actually has some sugar in it, but it also has fiber and other things. So you're not getting as much as quickly. Added sugar is just something that's dumped into a food as it's being processed. So Coke is an example.
But it is from sugar cane.
It is, yeah, but it's divorced of the fiber. It's processed in a way that it goes straight into your bloodstream. There's no fiber to slow it down.
Oh, that's
so there's more of it, and it hits your system much more quickly, which again overwhelms the pancreas. So yeah, I never discourage people from like eating an orange or an apple. Like no one's ever gotten type 2 diabetes, I don't think, from eating just whole fruit in moderation.
Sure. And like you said, there's fiber in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And vitamins and other phytochemicals. So the problem is when you're drinking a Coke and there's so much of it, sugar added to that, that you don't even know what you're doing until you finish it and you just slug down
50 grams.
Exactly.
Something big. I mean, like you look at it, just a normal can of, I don't know. I haven't looked at the last time I looked at one, but maybe like a Sprite or something. There might be like 48 grams of sugar or something crazy.
Yeah, that's
in a small can. Like I see people that drink the whole big gulps, right? The whole big ones, like probably triple, quadruple the size. That's got to be
maybe 120 grams of sugar, which is an insane amount.
What's a healthy amount per day?
Well, I think if you have prediabetes, if you have glucose intolerance like me, I think you should keep it probably 120 or below.
That's 120 grams of sugar. That still sounds like a lot.
I try to keep it under 80. I don't want to be. Some people have a hard time being that strict, but for most people, that would be quite an improvement just to get down to 120. For the average person, maybe it can go up as high as maybe 150 or 160 if they're active and eating a healthy diet. I don't think that's crazy, but the more messed up your glucose metabolism, the more strict you have to be, basically.
Hmm.
So again, you have to kind of do trial and error. You have these tests from your doctors. You see how your body's responding. So if you're on 80 grams a day and your blood sugar is improving, then just stick with that. If it's not, then you have to cut even more.
So what are you cooking? Like what's your breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
I really like eggs is kind of my go-to for breakfast. Maybe with some bacon. Again, it's protein and fat, obviously no carbs.
That's what I had this morning for breakfast. I had egg whites.
Oh, did you?
Probably like 6 or 8 egg whites. I'm trying to get a little bigger, bulkier because I'm doing this movie, but
okay.
I had a little of that and I had a couple pieces of bacon.
Yeah, it's a great breakfast.
Yeah.
For lunch, maybe just like a salad with some protein thrown on it, whether it's salmon or chicken.
Love salmon. Ooh.
And for dinner, usually just some steak or chicken and just some vegetables with it.
Yeah.
Again, just stay away from like the French fries and the baked potato and stuff like that.
What about a sweet potato?
Sweet potatoes are a little bit healthier than a baked potato.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you have diabetes, that's a very carb-heavy food. For an average person, I wouldn't say you have to avoid sweet potatoes. But if you have blood sugar issues, there's quite a bit of carbohydrate in that.
And what about brown rice?
Similar relationship between brown and white rice as there is between, I'd say, the sweet potato and the baked potato. It's better. It's healthier. But if you have diabetes, it's still a carbohydrate, and you still have to account for it. And just make sure that cumulatively you're not having too much over the course of the day. So you have oatmeal in the morning. Okay, that's a healthy carb, you think. And then, at lunch, you have a sweet potato. And at dinner, you have more brown rice. Those are all, quote-unquote, healthy carbs. But if you have diabetes, you're racking up way too much carbohydrate if you're adding it to every meal throughout the day.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of factors, right? Like if you're burning off a shit ton of calories because you're a triathlete.
That's totally different, yeah.
That's a totally different story.
Yeah. They have to fuel themselves with tons of carbohydrate.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about people who specifically have either prediabetes, diabetes, and glucose intolerance, where their body cells just don't handle sugar very well.
Yeah. And like to sort of round out what you were saying about cooking, I think that's it's really, really great. And you can do it really simple if you just condition yourself that you don't need a ton of sauces, a ton of crap, right? Like eating is fuel. And if you can get your head around that, it will really change the way you look at it. I know, when I cook at home, I'll cook for like 4 days, right? I'll cook like on Sunday. Like, you know, I got a bunch of chicken breast. Yeah, yeah, meal prepper. A bunch of chicken breasts or a bunch of salmon or, you know, a kind of a mixed combination of that. And I'll just do it super basic, right? I'll boil the chicken. I'll cook the salmon in some olive oil and, you know, maybe a little lemon. Maybe nothing fancy. Nothing fancy. You know, maybe throw a little dash of white wine on there or something. And, you know, then veggies, steamed veggies. Or you know, raw veggies, even better. But it's like really simple. If you can, I think the way people needs to, they need to get out of that, I need all this pasta with the sauce or this, you know, giant cheeseburger with this sauce and that. Right. And, you know, it's like, you got to remember, it's like, just think about how we would be as a person foraging through the forest, right? Like that's how we're supposed to be.
That's right. How we're genetically programmed, right? It's to be
like hunter-gatherers. Yeah. Hunter-gatherers. So, okay, what do you think? You see some veggies. Great. You know, like, oh, we grew some veggies there. Great, it came from the ground. I can eat that. That's pretty good for me. Green is good. Good lean protein.
Yeah, fish, the sort of thing you would have caught.
Fish, yeah. Fishing, got some fish. What would you say to people who are a vegetarian, right? And they're like, I need carbs. And like, so how are they going to get their protein? Or how are they going to get their energy if they're not getting, if they're just eating salad?
Well, I wouldn't tell somebody who's a vegetarian not to be a vegetarian, because people do it for a number of very valid reasons, whether it's philosophical, ethical, or just health reasons. But you can definitely get type 2 diabetes as a vegetarian. I think sometimes people think that it's this insanely healthy way of eating. And it can be, but it is a lot of carbohydrate. And there are a lot of people who are overweight and have high blood sugar who are vegetarian. And I think to some degree, they kind of think they're immune to it because they're not eating fat and meat. And again, sort of the misinformation from the past. But the carbs can really, really add up on that diet. So again, I think you just have to be really careful with it. And if you have diabetes and you're a vegetarian, you know, just make whatever adjustments you have to make to get your carbs down below a threshold that's healthier for you. Have you experimented with that, vegetarianism at all? Or?
No, not really. I like fish.
I like meat
and
too much.
You know, chicken too much. But I don't knock it at all. That's why I ask, you know, what would you say to a vegetarian who maybe, you know, solely relies on carbs throughout the day, right? They're so conditioned to eating brown rice or, you know, this, that, or the other. You know, sweet potatoes are, you know, good, healthy one, but it's like, okay. But if you're predisposed to diabetes, now you got to rethink that.
Yeah, you've got to sort of watch out. So at that point, I tell somebody to talk to their doctor and a dietitian specializing in that, because I'm not a vegetarian and I've never experimented with it. But again, just be really careful if you're diabetic and you have that many carbs in your diet.
What about things like honey?
Honey is sugar at the end of the day. I mean, it's still same deal. I mean, it's maybe a little, if it's natural and not highly processed, maybe it's a little bit better than table sugar, but not much, I wouldn't say.
Not much.
Same with agave and all those other things. I mean, if you have an issue with your blood sugar's too high, all of those things are going to impact it. So.
So you're writing for Men's Health now?
No, it was at the time. And then I did a story for the magazine called The Thin Man's Diabetes. Basically, the research I did on my father's situation and my own situation became that piece. I got a book deal based on that story, so then I wrote that book. And then I got a job at bodybuilding.com as the editor-in-chief.
Oh, bodybuilding. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, which I've been doing now for 7 years. So, and still writing books as I'm doing that. But I just wanted to transition to the digital side of publishing, which is sort of where everything's going now. People don't read magazines anymore unless it's online.
Sure.
So yeah, it's been a great experience.
Are you going to write another book?
Eventually, it's the only solo book I've written. I collaborate quite a bit with celebrities on their fitness and diet books, and I've done about 7 of those books and only one solo work. But I definitely would like to do something again on my own when I have time. So it's tough with a full-time job. I'm sure you like multitask with a million different things, but to actually write a really good, well-researched book.
It's tough.
It takes time, yeah.
How long did it take to write this book?
Pretty much about a year, I would say. including travel and reporting and all that stuff. A really focused, dedicated year.
So it was outside of sugar, and now we're talking about carbohydrates that we need to, you know, be aware of. What else do you think we need to be aware of in our diets?
That's a good question. I think too much alcohol, it's kind of obvious, and I enjoy alcohol, so I can't really bash people for doing it. But I think a lot of people drink way too much probably for their health, you know. That's one thing I would definitely tell people to watch out for. Trans fats, a lot of those have been eliminated, but it's a kind of fat that's specifically found in fast food and like baked goods and things like that. It's really, really unhealthy. It's pretty much like one of the leading ingredients for heart disease. So again,
what's a common food with trans fat?
Just like a box of donuts you might buy at the supermarket.
Oh God,
the best stuff.
The best stuff means no, people. No means no. What about things like? What about how I saw like I was in the grocery store the other day, and I still saw that margarine, right? Like I still can't believe it's not butter is still being made.
That probably has trans fats in it.
Like I saw something once where they showed that left out for like a month or something.
And it didn't change it.
It didn't change at all.
It's like a McDonald's hamburger.
Fucking same kidding.
Shit. Leave it out for 5 years. It's the same deal.
What are we doing?
That's a dead giveaway, isn't it? If you've got a burger that's been sitting there for a month and it shows no change whatsoever.
Yeah. Were they doing that with McDonald's too? Did they
There was, it was years ago.
What was this? The famous one about the guy. What was the guy who did the like 30 days of eating McDonald's? Remember that was
Supersize Me.
Morgan
Spurlock, is that his
name? Yeah, I think so.
God, disgusting. He looked sickly at the end of it, man. It was bad.
Well, it's crazy too. You guys were touching on it before, but when you're used to eating those kinds of things, and then you step away from it and you clean your diet up, and then you come back, you really recognize the negative impact that it has.
No, you really do.
Yeah, and your taste buds change and everything, and it's way too salty and
yeah, like if you're eating that stuff all the time, you could slip one in, you know, and it doesn't mean as much because you're like, whatever. I mean, you probably still feel like shit, but you just are like, well, I feel like shit all the time, so you're like, okay, whatever. I'm just a piece of shit. But when you, if you do, you know, if you're more conscious of it, man, it's like, no, I'm not doing that. I know how I'm gonna feel. I stress this a lot on this podcast. My dad had me eating salmon and broccoli for breakfast when I was young, and he's like, "No, this is what you're eating. This is breakfast." And he was like, "Look, food is fuel. That's what it should be looked at as. And you could cheat, you know. You could cheat. You gotta cheat too, right? Like, it's you can't be perfect all the time. Nobody's perfect,
right?
But I think that 80-20 rule, right? I mean, that's you gotta have that base, you know. You gotta do it, you know. And you can't just do it. Like, health has got to be a lifestyle choice. It's got to be a complete lifestyle, the way you live every day. What am I gonna eat today? Oh, I'm going to this meeting, and I can hit this healthy place here for lunch. You know, it's got to be like at the forefront of my mind. I mean, that's how I am. I'm to the point, like, I'm very selfish when it comes to like getting me and getting healthy.
And, yeah, I would call that appropriately selfish.
Yeah.
People should be selfish about that.
They should be, because if you're not selfish, then how are you going to be good to anyone else?
Yeah. You're not good for your kids if you have a cardiac event at age 40.
My buddy's always bugging his his girlfriend because she's got a terrible diet. And he's saying, "You want to have kids with me?" He's like, you got to prove to me that you can be healthy first. Why are you going to bring kids?
Yeah, we're gonna share a pantry.
Yeah, we're going to share a pantry.
I think that's legit. I mean, if you had a spouse who was like a chain smoker, would you be comfortable having
not a chance,
knowing that they probably wouldn't be around?
Not a chance.
Or that your kids would have to watch them die of cancer, you know?
Oh, it's terrible. It's so weird. It's like our habits, you know, like these things. We all have vices, right? Like, I'm not perfect at all. We all have them. But like, where do you think they come from in our brain? Where you're like, you know that's wrong. You know it doesn't feel good.
But you do it anyway.
But you do it anyway. And that's like what you're saying with like alcohol.
Or have you sensed the alternative? You know, you ate a specific way. Your motivating factor was a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So, and like I was saying, I used to eat a lot of shitty food and I just decided to try different things. And that was my awakening, if you will. But if you never have that transition to see how you feel with food as fuel, where's your,
yeah,
where's
I mean,
your motivation
look, it's,
come
it,
from?
It, look, and too, true, it's yeah. like you can't beat up everybody because it's the way you're raised, right? So like,
yeah.
there's so much of it that's inherent to...
That's the point that I was missing. That's how I grew up on all that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there's this little thing
so
called
that's what
marketing.
I thought was appropriate.
That, I mean, this stuff is marketed from the time kids are 1 or 2 years yeah. old, right? Breakfast cereals.
Oh, my God.
Coca-Cola's sponsoring school buses and
yeah, I mean, it's,
preschool chairs. And
so there's so much conditioning and imprinting, I think, that goes on early on. And I think that's probably why people do things. Yeah, why am I doing this? It's obviously bad for me, but something's compelling me to do it. And I think it's a lot of it's that conditioning that comes from advertising and marketing.
And parents being just lazy pieces of shit.
Yeah, I mean, the parent needs to then intercede and somehow yeah. create like a buffer between these influences and their kid. But
if your kid's like, I want Count Chocula and that's all I want to eat for breakfast, like 10 days, you know,
yeah,
in a row, you're being a piece of shit.
The problem is, what if the parents love Count Chocula too? Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
or what if you've just been like arguing with your child all day long? You're like, I got to get out of here. I don't care. Shut up with the Count Chocula habit. Just be quiet for 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's true.
It's easy being single. It'd be like, hey,
be better to your kids, asshole.
We got to pay for it.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah. Is there restrictions on what they can or can't advertise to kids? You know,
I'm
like,
not sure.
When,
I think
like sugar?
I think there's more than there used to be. There didn't used to be any at all. You see some of the old advertisements from the 60s. And like Coke was made to be this glamorous kind of sexy thing. I mean, cigarettes were the same way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there might be some restrictions on it now, but I'm not sure exactly what they are.
Hmm.
How does sugar creep into our diet? You were talking about fruits and fiber. I mean, if you're drinking orange juice and apple juice, and is that a pathway to too much sugar, to diabetes?
Yeah, orange juice is a good one. I'm glad you brought that up because that's ostensibly considered like sort of like a health food. Like, well, I'm not going to have a Coke. I'll have orange juice, and it has vitamin C, so it must be healthy. But there's just as much sugar in that orange juice as there is in the Coke because they've taken all the fiber out of it. So it's really no different. I mean, maybe there's a few, again, you'll get a little bit of vitamin C, but basically you're drinking orange Coke at that point.
Sure.
And now, an orange is great because then you get the fiber and there's not nearly as much sugar hitting your bloodstream, but orange juice is totally different.
Well, it's also like what you were saying too earlier. It's like we were not meant to just have all this stuff so accessible to us every day, right? Like having 5 glasses of orange juice, you know? I mean, like, what? No. Like, if you were lucky, you found an orange. Okay.
Right.
You know? Cool. You could eat an orange. You found an apple and an apple tree.
Yeah, that's how nature intended you to interact with sugar, is in the form of these fruits, but
yeah.
We're so far past that at this point.
And good luck finding an apple tree in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles.
Get arrested if you find an apple tree and take one.
So I'm curious about your anecdote about the salmon and broccoli for breakfast. Like, how did you react to that as a kid? Did you rebel against it, or were you like,
yeah,
cool,
rebel.
I'll do this.
No, hell yeah, rebelled. Because once you had sugar, it's a crack. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've had the good stuff. You don't want to go back. But, you know, he wasn't a lazy father. He's like, no, screw you. Like, you're eating this. Like, this is what you're eating. Like, this is healthy. Eat your broccoli. Finish your broccoli.
Yeah.
Because
he was pretty into bodybuilding. If I remember back to like the 80s and 90s muscle magazines that I ended up working for later, like Muscle and Fitness.
Yeah.
Like, I think he would pop up on the cover sometimes.
Yeah.
Just looking jacked as hell.
Yeah. No, he used to push a lot of weight around.
Like, I think of like Heartbreak Ridge and some of those movies. Like, he was in really good shape.
Really good shape. And people forget too, he was like 65 when he did that movie. Well, he was 60, yeah. He was old.
That's insane if you think about it. So,
he was, he's always been very, very strict. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know.
Where did he get it from?
You know, it's weird because he didn't, it's not like he grew up with all this knowledge. He educated himself. There was a time he ate cheeseburgers and, you know, that was, you know, back in the 50s when he was in his 20s, he did what you do in the 50s, you know, eat cheeseburgers and french fries. And then I think he learned that, you know, there was a healthier way, and this can't be that good for us to just continue to consume like
this. Was it film roles that motivated him to
I'm
be
sure
healthy?
I'm sure that had.
Because this kind of information wasn't around.
No.
Well, I wasn't around, so what do I know? But, it's, you know,
no, I think
certainly.
You're right, yeah. But there were actors like Bruce Lee that were really hip to health and fitness. So maybe he tapped into some of the same resources that those guys did.
Yeah, I don't know. He really pushed that short living fish, like salmon, had a lot of. Omega-3s. Mm-hmm. He always knew that was really good for your heart health, and then good greens.
But short life, is that what he said?
Well, there's different when you're talking about fish, right? Not necessarily every time, you know, you go and eat tuna all the time, you're gonna have a mercury problem. Mm. Long living fish, long living animals, but I think we see it a lot in tuna and long-living fish. They have they have high toxins in them.
Mercury and other
things. Yeah. Mm. And so you eat too much of that, and it can be dangerous. It can really be detrimental to your health.
Yeah.
Short-lived fish. The thing is really great about salmon, right? Like salmon live for like 4 years. They have like a They do the same thing over and over again. They're born in the river, they're spawn. Then they spend the first year or two of their life in the river, swimming and growing up as small fish. And then they leave and they go to the ocean. And then they go fatten up and they get bigger. And then they come back and they spawn, actually in the same place where they were spawned.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, that's like beyond, like the nature
that
can
strange,
go and do that, right?
Yeah.
You can like,
just some magnetic pull in their little brain or something.
Yeah. But it is weird. It is so, I mean, I was actually having this conversation today, right before you got here. I was on the phone with my agent, and we were talking about some Hollywood story and how it's neither here nor there, but it's just how someone was being ostracized for something. And I was saying, it's so weird how we don't live like villages anymore.
How do you mean?
We're kind of, and I think you see it more in highly dense places like here. We're just kind of out for ourselves more. Whereas, you know, you go to maybe Idaho, right? Or a place that's got less of a population and people congregate around one town. I find we start to slant back towards living in a community.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why I liked Idaho so much relative to these big cities, is that sense of connectedness to other people. Yeah, you're right. You don't get it here. You get it even less in New York than you get it here. It's just a blur.
And it's just, to me, it's like, it's so weird. I don't know what that number is. Like, what's the number of where we can, as humans, live together in a village where we, like, look after each other?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we look after, hey, I'm going to cook. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go get stuff. I'm going to help with shelter. I'm going to, you know, help grow vegetables and do that.
Yeah.
Like, what is that number? You know, like it's so weird that we're so out for ourselves that we don't even care about each other as humans. We're almost like, well, fuck that person. Like, I'm going to say
30 people.
30? Is it 30?
That seems arbitrary.
It's extremely arbitrary, but at some point competition's going to set in.
It's so weird.
But I do think some people, some groups of people kind of create that sense within larger contexts. So you can live in New York City, but you can maybe belong to a co-op or do some organic farming on a rooftop.
That's true.
And maybe meet some people at the gym who are of a like mind and kind of try to create those communities within bigger situations. But it's tough for sure. I mean, it's just such a rat race to survive.
Do you also think that there's maybe, like, how many people are we supposed to be in contact with? How many people are we supposed to remember?
As human beings? I don't know. That's a good question.
Like, how many people do you have in your phone?
Probably 100, I would say.
You have 100 contacts in your phone?
I would think so, yeah.
You could,
many of whom I'm totally out of contact with, but they're still there, I guess. And
like, if you looked at them, you'd know who they were? Or there are some that you'd be like, oh, I have no idea who that is.
No, I have a good memory for stuff like that. Anybody who I cared enough to enter into my phone was going to stick in my mind for eternity, for better
mind.
Or for worse. What's that?
I said I'm going to steal your mind.
You're not the same one.
No.
Well, you meet so many people as an actor that I'm sure it's your head must spin trying to remember who they all are, right?
I don't think it's normal. It's not. It can't be normal. It can't be normal. It can't be normal. And people get mad at me sometimes, and I go, look, you have to understand. I travel all over the world, and I'm gone for, like, I'm going for to this next movie I'm going to work on. And I will meet probably 200 to, depending on the size of the movie, like 200 to 350 people will be working on that movie that I'll work with intimately.
Just the actors and crew. And
actors, crew, set builders, drivers. Then you have all the people in that local community, right? Mm-hmm. You go out and you have to dinner and you meet people. And then I'll leave that town or that city and I'll go on to another movie. And I'll do the same thing all over again, right? And now you're like, okay, now you're at 600 people. How are you supposed to remember 600 people that you've met, right? And then you keep going. Before you know it, you're thousands of people that you've met contact with. You know, I'm sure there's people that are like, hey, we've met before. You know,
and you're then like, you fake it.
No, I don't anymore. I can't. I don't. I try not to. I do say nice to see you again when I introduce myself to people that I see, hey, nice to see you. And they're like, oh, we never met. And I'm like, oh, sorry. But it gets me out of a lot of it. But no, I mean, I'm honest. I'm like, hey, look, I'm sorry.
I think it would be even trickier. Like when you're like you in the public eye, because not only the people in the movie, but in your average day, I'm sure there are a million people approaching you saying, hey, I loved you in such and such, or I just wanted to say hello or get an autograph. So, I mean, those are like many interactions, but those must be in the thousands or tens of thousands at a certain point. So
yeah,
I can imagine you wouldn't remember.
Well, also too, I find that people, they look at you because you're on the screen or on a movie or on a TV show. And if they have met you before, then they feel like they know you. And then if I don't remember, then, you know, but I haven't had that same thing. I haven't had that same interaction because I don't watch myself and go, oh, like this is a movie and I'm watching myself in it. And like, there's that person that I know, you know, I'm not looking up at a screen thinking that because I've like, I did the movie and like, it's a different experience for me. Right. Like, it's just I don't like watching my own movies.
Really?
No.
You hear that a lot. I always wondered if that was BS, but it really does make you.
No, I don't think many people do. I mean, it's sort of unnerving, right? You're watching like a performance you did, and you're going ooh, and you're judging yourself. Right. Second to that, you already did the movie. You already know. You spent 3 months, sometimes 6 months of your life on this thing. Mm-hmm. You're done with it.
Probably sick of it. Sometimes
you're totally sick of it. You're like, I am ready to move on. Mm-hmm. So it's a different experience. You're also watching it going like, oh, I remember what we were eating that day. Oh, I remember that day. That day sucked. You know, that day was cool. Oh, that day sucked. So you don't have the same relationship
to it. It's not fresh, yeah.
No.
So Robin Dunbar, whose name keeps coming up, says we can only ever have 150 friends at the most. whether in a Facebook group,
I have thousands
or in
of people
society.
In my phone. I don't know who they are.
Yeah,
I don't know who they are.
You have more than 150. That's the problem.
I mean, and I would say I probably have in my phone book that I know like 300, maybe more. I don't know, but I have way more than that in my contacts list that I have no idea.
How many truly close friends do you have? Just sort of in a circle of people who are absolutely indispensable to your, not only your life, but your happiness.
I'm pretty lucky in that regard, actually. I've got a bunch because I grew up. I still have a ton of friends from high school I grew up with. And I got lucky. I got lucky with a group of core friends from all different circles. I don't know. I'd probably say 15.
I think that's what matters.
Yeah.
That 15 is what matters at the end of the day, not the
100
people who you sort of casually know from a past experience.
Yeah.
Harvard did a 75-year study about happiness, and half of the, I might fuck this up a little bit, but I'll get close. Half of the sample size were upper society, Harvard type people, and the other half were blue collar workers in that same town. Tracked them for 75 years. It's still going on today. And what they found was the biggest determining factor in health in later life and satisfaction was quality of relationships. It wasn't how much money you made, how hard you worked, any of that kind of stuff.
So true. I mean, when you say it, it sounds like it makes sense, right?
Yeah, it seems common sense, right?
Totally
common sense. But that's not what we chase. That's not what we put our energy towards so often. And we'll even sacrifice
so we can
our
buy more sugar.
Yeah, exactly. Need more sugar, man.
Give me more sugar. It's so true, though. Why are we so? It's so terrible.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
I think it'll ever change.
So, relationships and no sugar. That's what's up.
You think it'll ever change? A million years from now, you think it'll just be like, no, like we remember when we used to like do this thing about money and like trade these things. Now we're just we just don't do that anymore. Think it ever could go back, or greed will never allow it, right?
I don't know. If there's enough poor people, I think there's power in numbers. Who knows? If it's not working for enough people, something will change. Yeah.
My hunch is that greed will destroy the planet before we have a chance to see that happen.
Very possible.
Maybe
it's the environment or
just
that profit motive. I hope not.
Well, and that's a big part. We've been dancing around it a little bit, but that's a big part of the sugar problem, right? Is greed in a sense, because
it's profitable.
We know that these things are not good for you, but the ADA still denies, or at least is not accelerating the knowledge that maybe we need to change our ways. And there's certainly not any commercials out there going, hey, maybe back your sugar down. It's just more sugar, more sugar, more sugar.
Right.
And energy drinks, more sugar, more sugar, more everything.
Or at least some sort of regulation. Yeah, like you can't have 50 grams of sugar in one soda. Like, we're not going to allow you to have that.
It's a health hazard, basically.
Yeah.
So
you know, you could cut it in half. You know, like, man, look at these. I'm so stoked that we're living right now in this time, because there's a ton of cool companies now. Like, you see, you know, like LaCroix and Waterloo and these, like, these cool companies that are popping up that are just naturally flavored water.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And
kombucha.
You're like, they're, like, really good. They're amazing. They taste great. You like don't have to have this thing that has, you know.
I agree. And then it's inflating our healthcare costs and making people just not feel good,
right,
during the day. You know.
But remember, I mean, healthcare is also an industry and unto itself too. So.
Right. And one feeds the other.
Yeah, dialysis centers. It's a big business. So there's always constituents that are sort of living off of these health problems, along with tons of people who are trying to correct them and doing amazing work. So, I mean, it's always a really complex dynamic, I think.
Super complex issue.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. We talked about that the other day. Like, just such a complex issue, because there's so many factors, like how you were raised, you were, you know, like, okay, cool, the information's out there, but if you were raised, you know, poor and uneducated and you don't have those resources, it's like, that's tough, you know? That doesn't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People are just trying to survive. I get it.
Yeah.
And just the emotional aspect of eating. I mean, there are people who get depressed or nervous or upset, and the first thing they do is reach
for food,
a cupcake or a Coke or something like that.
So makes it feel good, right?
Yeah.
Get that little dopamine release.
Exactly, yeah.
You know?
But then you crash. And you feel like shit again.
Yep. Well, yeah, it's certainly not a solution to anyone's mood problems.
So have a salad and do some push-ups.
But people gotta, like, be careful with the sauces, too. That's the thing, you know? Like, people are like, I ate healthy today. And you're like, well, what did you have? And you had, like, this, you know, oh, I had a chicken breast and this thing with that, but you, like, smothered it in all this sauce. Like, you could be destroyed by the sauce you had on it.
Obviously,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, no, like, what are you doing? You don't need that crap on there.
Yeah, Asian restaurants do that a lot. There's a lot of vegetables, so ostensibly it seems healthy, and there's some brown rice, but the really sugary sauce they pour over everything pretty much turns it into an unhealthy meal.
Yeah.
Is that better? I mean, I guess we don't want the sugar, but I mean, it's better than Count Chocula. At least there's a piece of broccoli underneath.
Yeah, it's better than some other things, but it's I think it's an illusion if you think that's healthy eating. Yeah, the sauces it's a great point, or a really stealthy way to rack up not only carb calories, but just calories in general. You have no idea what's in those sauces.
I'm going to tell you what I'm going to cook tonight for dinner. Okay, guys? I'm going to go home, and I'm going to cook a piece of salmon. I'm going to steam some broccoli, and I'm not going to have the sweet potato. I'm not going to have it. I'm going to go super light, light and lean.
I like it.
That's what I'm going to have for dinner.
I like it.
It's going to be delicious.
And all that stuff can be so complicated, and that's how it was for me. And then to your point, Jeff, about cooking from home, and your point, Scott, about hunter-gatherer, it's like that's what I started doing. I would go through the grocery store. If I was outside, what might I find?
Yeah.
And then let me just throw that into a cast iron skillet with some salt and pepper and call it a day.
Yeah.
And it might not be the most delicious thing I've ever had, but I started doing that, and then I started feeling better.
Yeah.
And it's simple.
Simple. Keep it simple. You don't have to be a great cook. Just get it in your body.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm, you know, I am... It is a more of a complex issue, like we said, because having resources to have, like, better, you know, have a piece of salmon, have a piece of better, you know, like, that is, you know, those cost more. That can cost more. So it is complicated, but there are ways to do it.
And it has to be done. I mean, it's, if anyone thinks that having 1 in 3 adults with prediabetes is acceptable, like, how's the society? Did we get to that point? That's just
an
appalling number. So,
how do those numbers relate worldwide? You're talking about that's here domestically, right?
That's domestically,
right?
Yeah. It's pretty much every industrialized country at this point has a type 2 diabetes problem. So, I think those numbers are mirrored elsewhere in Europe. Maybe a little bit less in certain European countries, but the Middle East has a huge diabetes problem now. China has a huge diabetes problem.
Wow.
Yeah, for some reason, I guess it's genetic. The Chinese get type 2 diabetes faster. Like, they don't have to gain as much weight to get type 2 diabetes. So, and they're not sure why that is, but the numbers there are staggering as well. And again, it's basically wherever fast food has infiltrated, and that's pretty much everywhere, they're going to have these same issues for the reasons we discussed, you know. Too much sugar, not enough fiber, cheap calories, super easy to access, and...
What do you think of intermittent fasting, being the editor that you are?
I like intermittent fasting. I mean, it's pretty controversial. We've done a ton of stuff on it at bodybuilding.com. I'm not sure if it works for the reasons people say it works, or if it's just a way to reduce calories by shrinking the window in which you eat food. But I think it's probably, it seems like a more natural way to eat to me. Again, thinking back to like the hunter-gatherer paradigm, you're in that situation, you wouldn't have access to food every half hour, every 2 hours. You would eat, and then you'd go looking for something, foraging, hunting, and that might take you 8 hours to find your next meal, right? And I think IF kind of mimics that approach. So it's probably, to me, more natural and healthy.
Also, we ate probably during daylight hours, you know?
True, yeah.
We got up, then we searched for food, and then we either found something or didn't, and then went to bed when it got dark.
Yeah,
you know, and sometimes you went to bed hungry, right? I mean, that's what would have happened. And I don't know, I can't remember. How many days can you go, the human body go without food typically? And you can go 30 days,
I think it depends on how heavy
right?
you are. If you're heavy enough, you can go.
A long time.
There's a lot of fat to burn off for some people.
I think there was a I think Rhonda Patrick was telling us about a super obese guy that went close to a year.
Really?
Yeah, but for regular people, I think she was saying 3 to 5 days.
No, it's got to be longer than that. That's like water.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think you could go for, people have gone for a lot longer than that, right?
Yeah, I've done 3-day fasts.
Yeah, people myself. Go, no, people yeah. people go like.
Well, I mean, maybe that was the healthy choice. Maybe that was.
No, but I think that just the mindset in itself that I need to eat these three meals is, no, you don't. And you don't need the three desserts either. And the bag of chips and the candy and the thing in between it all. Like, you don't need that. You can go a day without eating. Yeah. You can fast a day. It's going to be okay. You go to bed hungry.
Yeah, is that the end of the world, really?
I mean, yeah, go to bed hungry. It's fine. Like, chill the fuck out.
You might learn some things.
Yeah. You might feel better when you wake up. You know, you might be like, oh, wow, lean and mean right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somehow we survived as a species by people going hungry a lot. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming in today.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. It's been an interesting conversation.
Yeah, we're going to do another one. We're going to do another one, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk some bodybuilding.
We're going to talk some bodybuilding after this.
Some fitness.
Oh, okay, yeah. Cool. Let's do it.